on the one hand, it's not personal, that it is a numbers game. There's a lot of randomization that happens. But on the other, it's intensely personal because for founders, it's your company. That's the survival stage, and you've got everybody hanging on to you.
Hey, this is the Built in Seattle podcast. I'm Adam Schoenfeld. On this show, I chat with Seattle's best entrepreneurs, operators, and investors about how they think and how they operate. On this episode, I met with Sandy Lin. She is the founder and CEO at Skilljar, which sells customer training software to the enterprise. In this conversation, we talked about Sandy's most recent fundraising process, where she went down to Sand Hill Road and raised over $16 million despite her car breaking down in the process. We talked about how she grinds and how she learns and why she was able to leave Amazon to go found Skilljar. I love learning from Sandy. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm sitting here with the one, the only, Sandy Lin, and we're in Skilljar's amazing Belltown office. So Sandy, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. We've had a few breakfasts together ever since your Techstars days. And I know you've really put your foot on the gas since you raised a large round last year. It was $16 million and change. How has that changed things for you as a founder and changed things for the company?
So I think especially for Seattle companies that are living hand to mouth and scrapping it out for the first few years, getting your first large institutional round of financing changes everything. It changes the type of talent you can attract, the type of customers that will talk to you, and it changes how the world perceives you.
I want to talk about the fundraise process, like the nitty gritty for somebody who's out there about to do it or thinking about doing it. But tell me, what does it mean like the early years were really hard? What was that kind of pain like? How did that actually look and feel?
Yeah. So Skilljar, we've been around for, I guess, in existence for about 6 years now. And the first 2 to 3 years, there were a lot of product pivots. There were a lot of team changes. And we were mostly just living on our $1 million angel raise coming out of Techstars. And, you know, there's a saying, I think Y Combinator started it, of being ramen profitable, which means if you're paying yourself minimum wage and, you know, being as scrappy as ever, you can somehow survive. And that was the case for a long time. And for us in our market, we generally can't sell to small companies, and we generally don't have any sort of freemium motion. So every single customer has to be sold, and every single customer is of a somewhat legitimate size, where they look at this, you know, 5 or 6 person unfunded company in Seattle and, you know, really question why they should do business with us, even if they are a Fortune 500 company. And so those years were really tough.
So, okay, these early days, and I knew you then too, and I know you were grinding it out one at a time, and you did that for a long time. Now, last year you raised this large round. How did that come about? How did you decide it was time to raise the funding? And then I'd love to dive into how you actually brought that round in.
Yes. So there's actually 2 rounds that I tried to raise from the Bay Area. One failed and one was successful. So I think to understand the second one, you have to understand the first one. So we wanted to raise our seed round. So I was trying to cast, and we'd been intending to raise, I don't know, 2 million or 3 million or in that territory. And so I have great angel investors in Seattle, many of whom will be on your show, and, you know, lined up. I think I targeted 50 warm introductions, both in Seattle and Silicon Valley and some in New York. And it was incredibly eye-opening and humbling that even with the most qualified warm introductions, I could barely get meetings. And I can go into the why and where like later, but at the end of the day, I think seed investing is largely local. And at the time, this is like maybe 2015 or 2016, the Bay Area was just flooded with seed opportunities. And so if you're a seed investor in San Francisco, it's just so much more extra work and thought to take meetings with a company that's not there. And so the experience was very, very hard, because when you're in your seed round, you're also struggling for survival. At that point, we had a handful of customers. We had a handful of team members. I knew we were onto something based on the early signals from the market. And we had, you know, a couple Fortune 500 customers that had gone to bat for us and implemented the solution. And there's no, in B2B, there isn't there isn't that much room for, you know, failure or wind down. It's, you've got to keep going. And we ended up raising a really great round locally from investors that I really support and are awesome Trilogy equity partners. But it was a very, very tough experience. And I had to go not to just plan B or plan C, but be thinking about plan D, like in this process. And so I really was not eager to go raise another round again. So we had gone from, we tripled in, I guess, 2017. We'd gone from like 1 to 3 million of ARR. And these days, or then and now, I think most people look for at least 1 million of ARR. So I knew we'd exceeded that benchmark. We'd exceeded the triple benchmark. We were actually pretty close to cash flow even, and in some cases, cash flow positive. We had a fantastic set of customers. We still were mostly surviving on inbound organic demand, but those were amazing logos. And so really, I felt it was ready. The product was there. The market was there. The story of how Jason and I thought about the market was there. I mean, when we raised our seed round, I probably couldn't have told you exactly what customer success was, but now I understood the value prop with enough customers to go out there. And I think, in fact, if my seed round hadn't been so bad, maybe I would have gone out sooner. But this time I said, I want undeniable traction that like everybody that I get introduced to will have to take a meeting. And the Series A went completely the opposite of the seed round. I think we had 6 or 7 term sheets in you know, 20 days. And so for better or for worse, that's what happened.
Right. So that's about as good as it gets, you know, 6 or 7 term sheets on a fast process, right? Obviously having a competitive round means you're going to get the kind of deal that you want, the kind of money in, the kind of valuation, the kind of investors. Contrast that with the seed round a little bit, just to underscore like the pain you were feeling, the hangover of that maybe. You had 50 warm intros. How many no's did you have to take?
Well, the problem is when you're in a seed round, I mean, I wish you could get the no's. Out of 50 warm intros, I probably got, you know, I actually pulled the numbers at some point, but I maybe had, you know, 8 meetings, 8 no's, and the rest were just silence. And silence is the worst. Actually, I appreciate the no's more than silence, or you have one meeting and then there's no follow-up because you just don't know. And as an entrepreneur, if you're fundraising, you have to get that done.
How'd you internalize all that silence and the no's?
Well, I think you have to try to make it a numbers game. In fact, I would refer frequently to a slide share about B2B, hacking B2B fundraising. I highly recommend it by Adam Schoenfeld.
I've seen that one.
Well, the interesting thing about that stage of company, both with customers and with fundraising, is every day is a new day. And you never know if tomorrow is the day that Google calls you on the phone, or the next day that an investor that you really wanted says yes to your meeting. And so you've really got to do your best to just give every day it's best, because there's still a lot of random things that happen at that stage, and it's a very magical time. And with investors, and I'm sure Dan Shapiro can talk about this too, you only need one. And he told me very early that you can't A-B test fundraising. In fact, if you had 10 companies in the exact same situation, and if there were a way to A-B test, you would end up with 10 different outcomes. So on the one hand, it's not personal, that it is a numbers game. There's a lot of randomization that happens. But on the other, it's intensely personal, because for founders, it's your company. That's the survival stage. And you've got everybody hanging on to you by a thread. And that's a lot of pressure. In the very beginning, when there's nobody around, then you have nothing to lose. And at our stage now, I mean, we have a lot to lose, but we're in a place of safety. I think the seed stage is really hard, because you have a lot to lose and you don't have enough to be in a sustainable position.
Right. Yeah. Very different stage when you went out and you had all these marquee customers, you had the tripling growth, you had all this validation, right? Versus the seed, where an investor could pose a more existential question to you about, does this even need to exist?
Yes. And it's a different class of investors as well that are, you know, less educated about the market or investing in general. So they ask very different types of questions.
So let's talk about the round that you did. And how did you make that happen? Because that's a pretty incredible outcome.
Yeah.
What did the process look like? What were the mechanics of it that got you where you wanted to go there?
You know, I may have overthought it too based on the seed round. So I did the same thing. I had a target list. I think it was of 20 VC firms that were good fits based on stage, B2B SaaS. And the one criteria I had to be a tier A prospect for me, if you use the terminology, is they had to have made an investment in Seattle. Because when my experience of the seed round, my conclusion was if an investor hasn't done a deal in Seattle yet, they're not going to, or at least they're not going to with me. And so that I looked at who has done Series A enterprise software in Seattle, which pretty much gives you 10 results, if that, and then tried to find a few that I thought might be open to Seattle or I had warm intros to otherwise. And then, you know, so I started raising in early or mid January. So I'd really spent December working on the deck, practicing. Actually, it's a good time to prepare for fundraising because, you know, there's not as much going on sometimes with, you know, conferences or travel or whatnot. So I spent a lot of the holidays sort of working on the story and getting all the diligence materials together so that I would have them prepared. I did FAQ and all of that before I talked to a single investor. And then some of them I already had met once or twice over the preceding 2 or 3 years or had some kind of warm intro to. So line up the intros. I told my team, like, I'll see you in 6 months. Like, I'll just be in the Silicon Valley for the next 2 quarters, and lined up a whole bunch of, you know, first meetings in the second week of January. And Rajiv Batra, who ended up co-leading our Series A, like, he'd actually been interested in the company for several years, and I'd never felt it was ready to actually go, or I didn't feel ready to go, you know, run a process. And so he was, you know, one of, if not the first VCs to move. We actually did our partner pitch with Mayfield, I think, on a Thursday. He was very bought in. and I remember going out to dinner that night, and I think it was a Thursday with their partnership, and Rajiv was like, oh, I have a term sheet in my backpack. Do you want it? And I was like, no. Because I at that point, I already had a few like partner pitches lined up for the following Monday. And I was like, I don't want it yet. And he's like, okay. But then the next day he sent it. So I think if you can find a true believer, and in our case, it's somebody who I'd known for a couple years and had really strong interactions with and believed in the business and believed in me and was ready to move. And then it really forced other firms to move. So absent that, like, I don't know what would have happened, but at least for me, like, having, you know, somebody that really believed and was willing to put a term sheet down and enough other investors that were almost like at that stage made the process move really quickly.
Tell me how it feels in that moment when the table turns with the VCs of you're pitching 10, 15, 20 firms, and then all of a sudden the tables turn and they're bringing you term sheets and now they're like wanting in your company.
It feels unreal because it probably is. It's very stressful in its own way because it's a big decision. And, you know, VCs say you have 24, 48 hours to make the decision or whatnot. And there are relationships at play, and entrepreneurs only go through a fundraise every couple years at best. And then every subsequent raise is actually, it's a different type of raise, a different type of people, different types of structures. And so it's all very stressful. And it does, at least for me, like, I did feel very skeptical because some of these firms in another context maybe wouldn't have been so interested. Are they interested in the company? Or are they just interested in getting into the next hot deal? That's what I was asking myself. There was a firm in New York that was ready to give us a term sheet without ever meeting me or the company. And so I decided to fly out there and spend the weekend with them because I wouldn't have seriously considered their offer having never met them in person. Stuff like that was happening, which was just very weird. Like, you would really give me a term sheet having never met me in person or met the company. And I'm not sure that I'm prepared to actually consider having you join the board or, you know, be a significant equity holder in the company without that happening.
I think most people in that situation, they're just like, wow, more people want in, but you actually parsed who wanted in because of FOMO versus who wanted in because of me and my company and like what we're trying to do here.
I'm not sure I ever was able to piece it out, but it did feel unreal because, you know, 2 years prior, it's nobody would even give me the time of day in the Bay Area. And now all of a sudden people were beating down my door or like, you know, offering to do all these things. And I was getting phone calls from CIOs of, you know, Fortune 100 companies about how much they liked firm X or firm Y. And I was like, what world am I living in?
Yeah, when the table turns, they really do put on the full court press. It's a fascinating thing, right? Like they're leaning back in their chair, just waiting for you to give the pitch, not really reacting to your slides until the moment they want to give you a term sheet. And then it's like a totally different thing.
Yeah, and then it's really hard to say no. At least I found it very hard to say no because there's a lot of great investors out there that I'm sure would have all helped this company move forward.
Yeah. In that sort of decision point, how much of what VCs do in these, oh, you have 48 hours or constraints that they create are real versus just kind of gamesmanship?
I think you'd have to ask a VC that.
Well, how do you measure that out, like as the entrepreneur, to figure out how much leverage you actually have, right? Because now they're trying to force the deal in their direction, right? With timing or this or that, like some variables. Do you think a lot of it is just posturing or are they real that, oh yeah, we're going to pull this term sheet in 48 hours?
I think if an entrepreneur has multiple offers, then you have leverage. And so it is astonishing how quickly the balance of power shifts because it goes from, I don't even know how many times a VC gets pitched a year, let's say hundreds, and they might really only like five or less, and they might only give term sheets to two or less, especially if it's a firm that's going to stand by their term sheet. And then all of a sudden, they really, really want you. And then the entrepreneur's in the driver's seat, and especially if the entrepreneur has multiple good options, then I do think that the VC firm is still going to be there. If that partner wanted to do the deal today, they want to do it tomorrow. Maybe they won't want to do it a month from now, but they'll like you just as much today as they did yesterday, unless something weird happened. And so I think it does shift very quickly.
It's a super interesting dynamic when the table turns on that. So you had some interesting stories like having to go back and forth to the Bay Area. I heard you got a flat tire at one point on Sand Hill Road. Can you talk about just the physics of, oh, I have to like go down there? And how did you manage that being from Seattle?
Yes. So I had learned from my seed round that face-to-face is super important and developing a relationship, which isn't about, you know, getting coffee or drinks. You're still talking about the business, but you get to understand how people think and react. And I think it was really hard to try to raise a seed round not being in the same city for that reason. So that's why for the Series A, what I told the team and what I intended was I'm just going to live in the Bay Area. My family lives there, so I knew I'd have a place to camp out. So I would always be there. Regardless, to take the meetings or whatever to start get to know people over time. And it started moving so quickly that I usually just take lifts around everywhere, but I got to this place like a week or two in where I would just, I had the final Monday, I had three partner pitches in three different cities. And like that was not even going to happen, much less in the Bay Area. I think I had two or three more in the Bay Area itself. So I'd rented a car. And of course, being a seed funded company, it was like, you know, a really old car that was the cheapest thing possible that probably had 100,000 miles on it. So I'd rented a car so I would have more reliability of getting from Sand Hill Road to Palo Alto to San Mateo to San Francisco, like on some kind of schedule. And yeah, I was pulling out of one VC's firm on Sand Hill Road with the, you know, 15 minutes to get to the next VC firms on Sand Hill Road. And I start the car and I pull out of the parking space and it wasn't a flat tire, but the engine just died. And so I just like coasted into like another like parking spot in that lot. And I was like, crap, what am I going to do? And like would run. The next one was actually, it was probably like a 10 minute walk away. So it wasn't that far, but I was going to drive. And I ended up just leaving the car there for like 2 days because I didn't have time to deal with it. And at this point I have VC firms offering to send their associates after the car because a rental car, deal with a rental car company, deal with everything going on. But I was just kind of throwing up my hands because I couldn't keep track of anything anymore. And also, this is a stage where, you know, I didn't have an assistant or anybody to manage my calendar or tell people I was going to be late and whatnot. And so it's very, the logistics can be very stressful when, you know, you don't live in that city, you need to be around a bunch of places and you don't have reliable transportation. But I probably cheaped it out a bit too much and should have gone for a nicer place. And actually, I remember when you, I think we texted during this time, and you're like, oh, you know, we got to get upgraded in Alaska. I was like, Alaska, I'm like on Southwest.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you hadn't raised the round yet. Yeah. You're still flying on a budget, traveling on a budget.
Still fly Southwest.
That's good. Keep it with the roots. So, okay, your car broke down. Fundraise. You can't make that stuff up. I mean, that's perfect. So I think companies here in Seattle, we have to deal with that dynamic a little bit differently. Like that wouldn't have happened if you lived there and had a car and you were familiar with the area. Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to be able to stay with my family. But if I didn't have that situation, then I don't know how entrepreneurs, you know, pay for hotels or just sleep on people's couches for, you know, months at a time.
Yeah, it can be, like you said, it could be 6 months of just spending time there, going back and forth, whatnot. Let's talk a little bit more about the fundraise, and then maybe we'll change gears. You said you did a lot of work up front and maybe overstructured it. You did a lot of the diligence up front. You really planned it out. Do you think that helped accelerate the process for you? Is that something you'd recommend to others?
I would recommend doing whatever it takes to give yourself confidence going in. For me, I wanted to be super, super well prepared, and that was what I needed to feel super well prepared. So I think it's very different from person to person. And I knew that I wanted to have everything lined up behind me and know off the top of my head what is our, you know, cohort-based gross and net retention and, you know, sales cycle by segment and all of that. I just wanted to know that I had quick access to it before going in.
Is that generally your style?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen you, I've seen some of your speaking and met with you enough times to assume that that was your style. So you prepare, you believe in preparation.
Yeah. So I actually just read this book called Quiet by Susan Cain. And it's, I think the subtitle is, you know, Introverts in an Extroverted World. And one of her points is, and I'm quite introverted. And her point is introversion is not about being shy or not being agreeable or sociable. It's about how much you get overstimulated by new situations. And for me, and I imagine for most entrepreneurs, fundraising is very much a new situation and with high stakes. And so the more something is like that, such as speaking or recording podcasts, then the more I like to feel prepared to reduce the amount of kind of new stimuli that might be thrown at me in the conversation.
Where did that come from in your life? Were you always like your focus on preparation? Was it in sports or school?
Probably all of the above. And the introvert book would seem to indicate a lot of it is genetic.
But you've built the skill of preparation, right? The desire to prepare is genetic, but you've had to develop this as kind of a skill, a way you operate.
I think I've always had it. And it might be, you know, I'm a second generation Chinese American woman, and that grew up in the South. And so I don't think growing up, I ever expected things to magically happen or term sheets to magically appear or customers to magically sign a contract or anything to magically happen. And instead I grew up in a culture, society or family that, you know, expected, you know, me to work for whatever results I achieve. And if magic results happen now and then, great. But if I put in the work and the preparation, then that increases the likelihood of the result I want.
So Skilljar is then tailor-made for you. The early days of having to grind it out and all the pivots and the resilience and the one deal at a time, that's like the perfect Sandy Lin company.
I think it's the only way that I could have gotten to where we are today. But the perfect Sandy Lin company, actually the reason Skilljar is perfect is because it combines two things I absolutely love. One is customers and one is learning. And I got to do it with my co-founder, Jason.
So you left Amazon to do this startup. Do you think, like, it seems to me, this could just be my limited point of view, that a lot of people stay there for for a long time. I mean, why is that? Why aren't there more startups? Or maybe you'll tell me that my point of view is just limited. I don't see all the great companies come out of there.
Well, I think it's hard to leave the golden handcuffs. Now, when I left, I think the stock was something around $200. And I think it's like $2,000 or something more. And so there's no rational reason why somebody who can get a good job at Amazon should be a founder. It is, you will make far less money and you have far less impact. And so there's no reason logically why anybody should do it, except that they place a super high premium on trying. And even so, you've got to realize that most certainly you won't have the same, statistically, you won't have the same financial outcome versus just staying. So why would a normal person do it? It's crazy.
So you mean the entrepreneur places a high premium on trying?
Yes.
So that was you. You wanted to try.
Yes.
Okay. So that tips the balance from the 200 to 2,000 stock price and all the other things that go with being there.
I don't want to think about that too hard, but I'm also a no regrets kind of person. So I knew I wanted to try. It was the right time in my life to try.
Do you think that we'll see more people coming out of Amazon and like feeding the startup ecosystem here in Seattle?
I think the financial benefit to staying, especially at Amazon right now, is far too high, and the perceived risk of starting a company in Seattle is too high.
If Amazon were based in the Bay Area, do we think it would be the same dynamic?
Amazon does have people there now. I think you might see a few more, but still not to the degree that you see people coming out of Facebook or Google and starting companies.
So you think it's an Amazon thing versus a cultural thing here?
Also, nobody at Amazon has time to think about starting another company. They're just working too hard.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We got that on the record. All right. This has been amazing. I want to wrap up with the Supersonic Six. That's my corny name for the rapid fire round. So they are rapid fire questions. You can give long answers if you want, however long you want to talk on each of these. Number one, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I would say early stage capital, because economically it's too limiting to have founders that can walk away from six-figure salaries to become entrepreneurs and make $0 for years. And VCs have gone later and later. These days, you know, there's angel, there's fans, friends and family, angel, pre-seed and seed. And so now it takes years potentially of product development and execution to get to a Bay Area round. And in Seattle, because seed investors want to invest locally, it's just harder to get through all those rounds. And we have a good angel community, I think. And once you're at Series A, there's a lot of options, but there's not a lot of sources here for, say, a $500,000 to $2 million check.
Number two, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle? I know you have family in the Bay Area, but would you still do it here?
I would absolutely start it here. This is where Jason and I have networks over time. I think it's become a competitive advantage because of the talent here and knowing the area. And the early stage financing environment has improved, and Bay Area companies and even seed Bay Area firms are now starting to invest in Seattle, which wouldn't have happened 3 or 4 years ago. But I will say it's still probably 10x harder to raise early stage capital in Seattle than it would be in the Bay Area.
Number three, who's a Seattle company or founder that you're following or studying right now and why?
Well, I just spent a long plane ride sitting next to Manny Medina, who's the CEO, founder of Outreach, and I believe is on this podcast as well. So Outreach is a couple years ahead of us in the startup journey for the last 6 years. I mean, they went through Techstars a couple years before us, did some major pivots. You know, Richie led their A. So Manny's a good friend, and it's great to get his input on everything from executive hiring to how to give a keynote to international expansion. And he's gone through the trenches and experienced a lot of what's to come.
Number four, what's a truth that you know or believe but other people think is false or crazy?
Okay, so the truth I believe that other people think is false is most companies are not customer focused. And they say they will. Every company says they care about customers, but really only the sense of acquiring them and then to some extent treating them like a potential bag of money. And I've heard things like, you know, 25% adoption rates on products or 40% churn rates. And if a company were truly customer focused, they would be, I think, desperately trying to understand how to drive long-term value in a sustainable fashion. And I think this is a consequence to a little bit of the fundraising environment that rewards growth rate, and MarTech and sales tech and how sophisticated companies have gotten about eking out that extra 10% of your sales development team to hit your triple, triple, double, double, whatever. And the reality is it's much easier to close a new logo and sell a dream than it is to deliver on a daily basis for years after that. So I think most companies give lip service to customer focus.
Why customer focus as your value instead of customer obsession or customer centricity or one of the other versions of that?
Well, I don't think obsession is a good thing in general. And I don't know, I think focus is a good word.
Number five, what do you know today that you wish you'd known when you started your company?
I wish I'd known how hard sales is in general, and especially startup sales where you have no brand. I think I'm a product person by background, and I think so many great products probably die in darkness. And in Seattle especially, I think we're known for being great at building products, but not so great at scrapping it out with new distribution channels. So I had to learn the sales the hard way myself, and I'm still learning how to lead sales and go-to-market organizations most effectively.
Would you have still done it if you knew how hard sales is?
I'm not sure I would have started a company if I'd known how hard it was going to be. And this is allegedly successful entrepreneur saying that, but I would have.
I'm advising this Techstars company. You'd love it. They're going to sell an expensive enterprise product, and they have no idea anything about sales. And I keep thinking this is perfect. They just don't know what they're getting into.
Yes,
which
you need to not know what you're getting into, because otherwise you wouldn't do it. Otherwise, every idea looks really stupid when you're still in the founder stage. There's reasons why every business won't work.
Last one, number six. What ask do you have for this audience? What can this community do to help you?
Well, we just launched a brand new website at skilljar.com, and we would love for anyone to check it out and give us some feedback. And if you're growing quickly as a company and looking to better onboard, engage your customers, we would love to talk.
If you're ready to actually be customer focused and not just give it lip service and hire more SDRs.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you. It's an amazing story. I love hearing about your car breaking down fundraising, how you thought about things, how you've come over from Amazon. I've learned a ton from you today and always through all of our chats. For people that want to keep in touch with you, where should they go? Where should they follow you or connect with you or do one of those kinds of things?
I'm trying to tweet more. So my Twitter handle is Sandy S. Lin.
Okay. And that's S-A-N-D-I.
S-L-I-N.
Yes. Okay.
Or you can follow Skilljar.
Or Skilljar. Would you like to drop the mic?
No. Boom.